since this is the first time that we interact with us as a sixth parliament, it would be important that we introduce ourselves. I know that we have veterans who have been here for long, Honorable Horn, Honorable Mulaudzi, Honorable Glenis Breitenbach. My name is Bulelani Magwanisha. I am the chair of the committee, member of the ANC from Gauteng.
Kukutile Richard Janji, Western Cape.
Nomathemba Maseko Jele, Gauteng ANC.
Tola Ngola, African National Congress from the Eastern Cape.
Tshivani Mulaudzi, Limpopo, EFF.
Bulmanyuho Drukhan, Western Cape ANC. Sign language interpreters voicing for me. Thank you. Hi.
Hello, I'm just Glynis. I'm Glynis Breitenbach from the DA.
Good afternoon, I'm Werner Horn from the DA.
We have an apology from Advocate Mohammed. He'll be joining us late. He's still having a meeting with the Chief Whip. Over to you, Judge Malume.
Thank you, Chair, members of the Portfolio Committee. Thank you very much for receiving us so warmly. You have started by introducing your panel. Your members may also take the opportunity to introduce members of this organization. Starting on my left hand side is the Chief Executive Officer, Ms. Bidu Valandanka. And then on my right hand side, at the extreme right, it says CFO. Rebecca, Ms. Rebecca Tlavatau, sorry. And then Mr. Patrick Undermark, who's a CLE. And then going to my left-hand side, Mr. Matumele Seylan, who's chairperson, who sits on the board as chairperson of REMSEC. And then a new board member, Advocate Adila Chowan. Sorry, Michelle O'Dayan. Okay. Then Mr. Brian Ney, who is the national chief of NOE for the whole country, and then the person who leads legal aid in this province, Ms. Nolita Jali, sitting right at the extreme end. Chairperson, thank you very much. It's always an honor to be here to present. As you are here, we're here to present our annual performance plan. As well as budget for the financial year end 2019 to 2020. We'll soon be sitting to review our strategy for the next 5 years, say later this year. Legal aid briefly provides legal aid to to indigent and vulnerable persons who need legal assistance. And as we go on with the presentation today, you'll also hear about our challenges, mostly budgetary, because we only depend on government to fund us. Our mandate generally is directed by not only the Constitution, but also certain forms of legislature, as well as the common law. In terms of the Constitution, every detained and or accused person has got the right to be represented, provided that person meets certain requirements. And when I say every person, I mean every person, be it black, white, or red. We also have a very strong unit where, in terms of Section 28, the Constitution demands on us to protect the rights of children, as well as vulnerable groups. You all know that in terms of Section 34, every person has got the right to have a dispute, any dispute, be it in a criminal nature, of a civil nature, or of a commercial nature, to be adjudicated before a court. That person has the right to be represented legally. You also know that the courts have also, on many occasions, demanded on us to provide legal services, even where we may not have thought that it is correct. You recall the Marikana case, legal aid was, the court ordered that legal aid be provided. You also recall the case, an ongoing case in the criminal court in Johannesburg, I think it's Port, can't remember the person's name. But many years ago, the High Court ordered the legal aid to provide legal services for that person. You also would remember cases around the Buremach trial, which went for many years. And if I recall very well, some years ago, during the massacre in Shell House, legal aid had to provide legal services for them. So it is all inclusive, and everyone has the right to be represented on conditions with certain criteria. But if it falls outside the mandate, there are certain procedures as far outside the ministers. The procedures that are followed in terms of our regulations, and as well as also people have got the right to go to court to demand that they be assisted. Having said that, Chairperson, I now give over to the rest of the management team to do the presentation of the APP and the program. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Judge. We have a challenge with our project. I think we are facing the same challenges you have in courts with the air conditioners. In our case, we have the air conditioners, but the project is not working for today, but members have they have copies of your presentation, so they will not be prejudiced.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chairperson and honourable members. I'll just indicate which slide we're talking to as we go, so then you'll be able to follow it in the copy you have. So we now, Judge Makume spoke on slide 6, and we're now moving to slide 7 and 8. So we're talking about the strategic plan. So the annual performance plan is linked to our strategic plan, as with all other entities and departments. And as Judge said, in terms of legal aid, we get our mandate from the Legal Aid SA Act as well as from the Constitution. And largely, we provide legal aid services to people across South Africa through offices. We have 64 offices across South Africa. And we provide services directly to clients through lawyers that we employ. And so we are present at every criminal court in the country, and we are able to provide legal aid services. Then we also provide civil legal aid services to people who come to our offices, as well as we provide legal advice services. So I'm just providing some context so that when we talk about the programs, you know where it fits in. Because we are wholly dependent on government in terms of grant funding, it means that we have to have rules by which we would provide legal aid as with other government allocated services, and in our case we then use what we call a means test. So for people to qualify for legal aid, they have to apply for legal aid, and if they earn below the means test, then that is when they would get it. And in some instances, as Judge said, we would be able to provide legal aid to people who earn above it if the courts require it, or if they, what courts have said is substantial injustice would result. So those are very specific cases, but otherwise we work with the means test, both for criminal and civil matters. Legal advice, we don't really pay that much attention to means. We assist as many people as we can, especially in terms of our legal aid advice line, where people can phone in and ask for assistance. So when I'm looking at slide 8 and I'm talking about the strategic plan, then it links to that mandate, and that core business is what we are involved with delivering. And essentially we are completing our 5-year strategic plan, so the annual performance plan we're talking to you about today, it links to the last year of that 5 years, and even the budget will be the last year of that 5 years. If I move to slide 9, it then sets out the vision and mission of legal aid, and essentially, we, in terms of the vision, it's a far-reaching vision which says that we want a South Africa in which rights and responsibilities enshrined in the Constitution are realized to ensure equality, justice, and a better life. for all. So our focus is very much on justice and improving access to justice. That's essentially what we are about. And in terms of the mission, is the kind of organization we need to have to be able to deliver this legal aid services, quality legal aid services to people, and have an organization that is well-functioning and efficient. So that's why you can see it says to be the leader in the provision of accessible, sustainable, ethical, quality, and independent legal services to poor and vulnerable persons. On slide 10, and I won't go into the detail of that, but we set out the two broad outcomes we have of what we're trying to achieve, and then a lot of detailed objectives. Essentially, on the one hand, our focus is very much on delivering legal aid services to people, the public in South Africa, those who qualify. And on the other hand, to back that up, to be able to provide that legal aid service, we have to have an efficient and effective organization that is able to do that. So those are the two outcomes. On slide 11, we had set out strategic risks for the five-year period, and essentially those would be things that would affect our ability to deliver legal aid services. And what we then do is we manage those risks, to ensure that those do not become a hindrance to our ability to deliver legal aid services. And so that is the purpose of setting out those strategic risks. We also have other operational risks, but for this level, we're talking about the strategic risks. Again, I won't go into the detail. If there are questions, I'll respond to that. What I want to focus on is on slide 13 and 14 onwards, is to just to give you a picture of what Legal Aid SA, Legal Aid South Africa, is in 2019. And just as a reminder, Legal Aid SA, in terms of the legislation, we had a new law that was passed in 2014. That was the first post-94 piece of legislation linking to legal aid. Before that, we were governed by a very old act, which was from 1969. So in 2014, that aligned it to the Constitution and the constitutional rights. And in that act, we also changed the name of the organization. So that is why we're no longer Legal Aid Board. In the act itself, it's the Legal Aid SA Act. So that is why we now call Legal Aid South Africa, and that's the name we go by. And what slide 13 talks to is about our level of performance. And as you said, we are the last entity that you are hearing from the Justice Cluster. And being in the Justice Cluster, we're very much part of the justice family, and we want to contribute to making the justice system as a whole work, because it's no use any one part of it working when everything else doesn't work. So first and foremost, we see ourselves as part of that justice family, trying to see how we can make the justice system work. To do that, we must make ourselves work, and then we work with others to make the entire justice system work so that the people of South Africa have confidence in the justice system. And as legal aid, in terms of our part, as I explained, through our offices across the country, we have a delivery system which is of salaried lawyers that are employed by our organization. They deliver more than 95% of the work that we do. And only less than 5% then is done through private lawyers. So if you knew legal aid in the 1990s, it was the other way around. The bulk of the work was outsourced to lawyers, but then government decided they changed the delivery system. And so from about 2000, they started setting up these local offices or justice centers. We now call them legal aid local offices. And through that, we then provide the services. So essentially, we've been able to implement that delivery system successfully. We run that national footprint of 68 offices and 68 satellite offices. Currently, we are assisting over 724,000 people to get access to justice. And we do that through legal services. That means where lawyers assist, then also advice services, which is where our paralegals assist them. So that's the two levels. Also, we run a very efficient and a financially sound organization. We have 17 years of unqualified audits, and we've maintained that, and we're very proud of that record, which means that, and we know that as legal aid, we've historically always received a smaller share of the funds of the justice cluster. But government has stayed with legal aid, and that is what we are happy with, that government has still stayed and been committed to helping poor people access justice. But in doing that, we still receive the smaller share. So, but we then ensure that reaches as many people as possible, which is why we focus a lot on that. We focus on getting our governance right. And also, those of you who might remember in the 90s, legal aid was in serious trouble. It was bankrupt. Many of the stories we hear today about entities, that was legal aid then. And so we've had to turn around, and in that we've been successful. And our former chairperson, also Judge President Mlambo, he helped and he led that process. He just finished up now and Judge Mukume took over. So we then ensured that we run a very financially sound organization, and we are very committed to having clean audits and to making sure that whatever money we have, we can reach as many people as possible. And lastly, because we are providing legal services through our lawyers, it means that our most important asset is our people, our lawyers. And so we focus a lot on our people programs internally as well, including the client focus externally. But in our people programs, we then want to make sure we recruit and retain talent so that our lawyers are providing quality services, and that they are able to, and that they want to stay, and that they know and have the expertise to provide legal services in a range of matters. So in that way, what we've also paid attention to, and that is the last point on slide 13, is that we accredit ourselves with a group that accredits top employers. And for the last 10 years, we've been accredited as one of the top employers in South Africa. And for the last 4 years, we lead the public sector category of top employers. So we're very happy and proud of those things that we've achieved, because by having that people issues right, by having the finance issues right, it means it doesn't detract from our ability to do our core work, which core work is to reach as many people as possible and increase access to justice. In slide 14, you will see that what we got there is data. We are also very data-driven. Whenever we come to this committee, we will bring information which is gathered and it's accurate and it's reliable, because we depend on technology. And what this shows you is over the last 4 years of that strategic planning period, and we're now in the fifth year, how the different data has changed. So this slide here is focusing on the delivery stats. So you can see there's new legal aid matters, there's new legal aid advice matters, then there's what we call impact matters are strategic litigation matters, and when we talk about the programs, my colleagues will explain that. And then the total legal matters, that's where you can see that from in 2015 we were dealing with 749,000, we're now at 724,000 matters. And again, that will be explained and links to the way in which some of the stats, especially in criminal courts, they've stabilized in terms of the number of matters. Then we also focus on children and vulnerable groups. So children, you can see that we track those stats. Then in terms of the percentage of civil matters we do compared to criminal, again, we've tried to increase that because we need to assist more, but we also have to meet the constitutional mandate. So 13% of our matters are civil. And then the national footprint is the justice centers I explained and high court units, etc. Slide 15, we talk about the budget, and you can see the budget in this last financial year, it was 1.9 billion. In the current financial year, it's about 2 billion. So what we have is that budget has increased, and that again shows, the slides are up, so you can also look at it on there, slide 15, and that government has stayed, and we have the same budget cut as other departments and entities, but other than that, we have been getting the support of the National Treasury. The National Treasury and the Department of Justice and the Minister have been happy with us because of the fact that we perform and we can deliver on these results. We also spend the money. That means we don't want to return money, especially because we don't have enough to reach all the clients. So that is why you can see we have a strong record of expenditure. Expenditure as per our budget. So we're not just spending. It's only what we budgeted. And then in terms of the Auditor General's report, I've explained that to you. The next slide, slide 16, talks about the number of staff we have. And in 2018-19, the last financial year, we had 2,557 staff. Of that, about 80% of those are lawyers and paralegal staff. Paralegal is a very small part, but we have, so you can see that those are the people who are then delivering the service. And our recruitment levels are high. Generally, excluding contract staff, they're over 95%. Last year, you can see, it was 92.8%. And the reason for that is because of the budget cuts, we've had a bit of turbulence in terms of trying to manage the way in which we freeze post and then make sure that we don't overspend, etc. And that has been the cause of that particular year's challenge. And then I've talked about the best employer accreditation. Now we're going to move in section 5 to the actual annual performance plan and each of our programs. And the way in which we have our programs is in our annual performance plan and strategic plan is in four parts. The first part is on client, community, shareholder, and stakeholders. and then there'll be programs on each. So if we go to slide 19, I'll then hand over to my colleague who's the head of national operations, Brian, and Brian will take you through some of those slides, and then he'll hand over to Patrick who'll take you through the civil work. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honourable members, thank you. I'm now on slide 19. I'm going to talk to you about the business plan component, client, community and stakeholders. There's a few programs and projects that we'd like to bring to your attention. The first program deals with the delivery of quality criminal legal aid services that are client-focused and within budget. And here we're talking really about the project about providing access to legal aid services for clients in criminal matters. And we consider the coverage as an important aspect. So the target is linked to how do we cover the different courts. And you can see the targets outlined on the slide. During the last financial year, we achieved a target of achieved a performance of 84% and 94% for our district and regional courts. In the I courts, we cover all matters where clients require legal aid. So we aim in the new in this current financial year to continue this performance in terms of coverage of criminal courts. If we go to slide 20, we're dealing now with how do we contribute to the effective functioning of the criminal justice system in particular. And very much in this project is our participation at the various committees, both national and provincial, as well as the local efficiency enhancement committees. So we play quite an active role, being quite an important stakeholder in the system, and we ensure that senior representation is provided, and we play a proactive role in identifying and contributing to resolving many of the obstacles. So in this case, we participate at the NEC meetings, as well as the various provincial efficiency enhancement committee meetings, and stats on that are provided in our annual performance plan. We go to the next one. An important project here is also accounting to the executive authority and parliament. So there is a special project under this section. And on an annual basis, every quarter, we provide quarterly performance reports to the executive authority, as well as an annual report. And we are also presenting to Parliament as and when we are required to brief the portfolio committee. I'll hand over to Patrick.
Thank you, Chief. I will be dealing now with, in essence, civil and legal representation, as well as civil advice. So specifically, Program 2 focuses on delivering of quality legal services specifically to our client base with a priority focus on constitutional rights but within our available budget. You will see this year did deal with our stats overall, but civil legal representation makes up about 13% of our overall representation. Criminal representation makes up about 87% of the caseload that we have. You can see specifically in our last financial year, 2018-19, we assisted in 53,990 legal representation matters in civil. We do it by four different mechanisms, which looks at our own internal practitioners, which we did 86%. And then we also do it by cooperation partners, which we cooperate with either legal NGOs, SAS Law at the labour courts, or a lot of it the university law clinics, so that we cooperate with each other to extend legal services. And then also impact, but I will deal with that separately. So in those we exceeded our targets by about 9% in terms of what we determined from our overall. And you can see the budget is about $148 million that we intend spending this year on civil legal aid services. Then moving on to our program 3, which is then the delivery of quality legal advice services that are client-focused within budget. That specifically we do in two ways. One, by paralegals that are employed at our 64 local offices, which is our larger offices, and then at our 64 satellite offices, which are smaller offices that are within rural areas. And each office will at least have one paralegal. You can see in this last one, in 2018-19, we assisted about 308,000 people with advice in terms of specific issues that they have. And in this way, you try and assist people with advice so that they don't get into a legal problem. So it's early triage, but where they also consult and it is a legal problem, then it gets moved on to a legal practitioner so that they then can give it the necessary attention. So it's an important element in terms of service delivery. The second way we do it is also by a national call center, toll-free number, and we also have a please call me number so that if anyone doesn't have airtime or money to be able to phone, they can just send us a please call me to our system. It goes through the call center and we will call them back. There you can see our overall budget on that is about 57 million in the year. The third aspect I'm dealing with, which is our program four, is impact litigation. As you can see, in the last financial year, we funded and did about 30 new impact matters. So these we're trying to, with single matters, try and give content to our constitution, focus on constitutional rights, where with a large class action you can assist. For example, our funding in silicosis matter, which is now going to be one of the biggest settlements, class action settlements in South African courts, where the agreement that has been reached is now before court for approval. That we funded the Legal Resources Centre, and we've been involved in the silicosis issues with Legal Resources Centre for about the last 12 years. And so it's those kind of matters. We also became involved specifically in Life is a Domeni, where we funded both the families of deceased and where we ourselves represented the survivors and their families in the arbitration. And there our budget, as you see, is about 6.8 million on these impact tests. I'll hand now over to our CFO, Rebecca Clavertal.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be dealing with financial sustainability, which is the second component of our balance scorecard. So in this strategy, we're focusing on increasing financial sustainability and managing during budget cuts. The target for the year was to have a balanced budget for the MTF over the period 2019-20 to 2021-22, which is aligned to the strategic plan. In this budget, we had to take into account the 95 million budget cut, the 5% that affected most entities in this period. For the period under review, we spent and committed 98% of our budget. This was slightly lower to other years. As explained earlier, it was because of us being cautious and conservative to ensure that we don't overspend, noting that we had to take into account the 95 million budget cut. The target going forward for the financial year under review 2019-20 is to have a balanced budget, again taking into account the limited government grants and the available cash reserves from within the organization. Second component, deals with ensuring that we continue to comply with strong and best practice financial reporting to ensure unqualified audit opinion and optimum financial maturity. We prepared, or the target was to prepare annual and mid-year financial statements that are fully compliant with all financial reporting prescripts. For 2018-19, we did prepare financial statements that are compliant with all financial reporting frameworks and prescripts. There were no material adjustments as indicated from the AG's report. That year we received an unqualified audit report for the 17th year in succession. Again, for 2019-20, our target is to again prepare financial statements that are free from any material misstatements and also have an unqualified audit opinion with no matters of emphasis. In terms of governance, the strategy was to maintain and enhance good governance, again ensuring compliance with best governance practices, be PFMA, King 4, and all other relevant statutory requirements. there we are targeting to have 100% compliance with all the statutory requirements. We were materially compliant with the relevant legislation. Going forward, we still want to maintain complying 100% with the statutory requirements. In terms of combined assurance, Legal Aid SA cannot achieve what it's achieving on its own, so we have a combined assurance model where we various levels of assurance work together in achieving this. So more than 95% as the target for 2018-19 audit coverage was planned. In terms of performance, 102% was achieved. There were 6 additional projects that were outside the approved audit coverage plan that were completed and achieved by our internal audit department. For the year going forward, we have set the target of achieving at least 95% of the audit coverage plan. Okay, in terms of maintaining and enhancing good governance, there we have an effective and functional board. We had a properly constituted board in terms of the Legal Aid SA Act. During the financial year 2018-19, a new board and a new chairperson they were appointed effective 1 March 2019 because the term of the previous board came to an end. Again, during that period, the board was fully functional and fully constituted. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, I'm coming back and dealing with our internal business processes, so this is obviously one of our strategies that's most important. So the critical element, obviously all of this is the Legal Aid Act, and as the CEO intimated, we moved to a new act in 2014 that aligned with our final constitution, which was implemented on the 1st of March 2015. The board on a regular basis reviews the act for any issues where we need to clarify or improve the act. There are some amendments that have been approved by the board that's been submitted to the Department of Justice, who have undertaken that it will form part of the Judicial Matters Amendment Bill for 2019-20, which this committee would obviously get to debate at a stage. So that will come through, but we at least on an annual basis review our act to ensure that we maintain a good and a strong governance instrument. Linked to that, in terms of the Act, we have two critical documents that are dealt with in sections 23 and 24 of the Act, which are called the Legal Aid Regulations. That's the policy framework that's set and approved by Parliament in terms of who do we assist, what criteria is it in terms of that persons will qualify to be assisted, including the means test. The Fifth Parliament considered a revised means test to improve it and increase it and therefore increase the number of people that are able to qualify for legal aid assistance. So any of those amendments to the regulations have to be approved by Parliament, both Houses of Parliament, so it will normally be tabled by the Minister. That's for the policy and the policy amendments. We review that. The Act requires us to review it at least every 2 years. And so that will then come through, and the board then looks at those and the regulations and reviews it on an ongoing basis. In regard to the Legal Aid Manual, that sets out the procedures. So how do you qualify? It's more an administrative issues for us as to how do we administer legal aid in an open and a transparent manner, and then to able that we can, which forms do you complete, who's able to approve legal aid, and that is what's detailed in the manual. That document as such doesn't come through to Parliament. It is tabled in Parliament, but the Minister gazettes it immediately and it comes into operation 60 days after being gazetted. So that's the process for our regulatory framework around the Act, the regulations and the manual and the engagements that, and we are constantly reviewing, but at least the regulations and manual every 2 years. The other critical aspect, and I think the CEO alluded to this, is once again supply chain management. That's the place where a lot of things can go wrong, and it's important to have and maintain a strong supply chain management framework and practices. So from a Legal Aid South Africa perspective, that's something that we pride ourselves in terms of what systems we've put into place, the separation of powers, that you can't have any one person doing it, and then ensuring that we submit quarterly reports on the acquisition of goods in excess of 500,000 rand as required, and in indicating our compliance with the triple PFMA, PFMA, National Treasury Regulations, and triple BE as well, and submit those to a National Treasury. We've had, in the last financial year, 100% compliance with those acts, insofar as we've done from a procurement perspective. We've implemented our own supply chain management policy, and any approved deviations for bids above R1 million have been submitted to National Treasury and Auditor General in terms of the requirements of the legislation. Generally, you'll see our overall budget strategy within that is about R19 million. Thank you, Chair. I hand back to my colleague, Brian.
Thanks, Chair. I'll continue with the presentation. The last component of the business plan is the employee and organizational capacity and innovation and learning. Just a few slides that we want to bring to your attention. First one deals with the important strategy of how do we consolidate and review the national footprint to ensure access to legal aid services, especially in the rural and remote areas. And the program that we concentrate on here is appropriately staff all our service delivery points. So in terms of this, we try to review and develop staffing plans that meets our operational requirements for both the legal and the support positions. We have targets in place. In the past financial year, we had a high ambitious target of 98%. But our actual performance was much below that, at 92.8%. And that is primarily because we had to place a moratorium on filling of posts because of the budget cuts that was imposed on us and subsequently reversed. This year, we have got a target of 95%. Moving to the next strategy, how do we develop and expand the quality and expertise of each segment of our national footprint? Here, we look very much about strengthening and improving organizational competencies and expertise. And there's two projects here that we want to bring to your attention. One is skills development. So we're very much required to ensure that there's annual training plans. And we submit the annual training report to SAFCETA as well as the skills development plan. And this has been done in the previous financial year. And our target is to ensure that for the current year, we also comply with this requirement. The next project under the same program deals with employment equity, and the key goal here is to ensure that we have a diverse workforce in line with our annual targets to achieve the employment equity goals that we have set for us. Very much here is we need to ensure that we have a plan, employment equity plan and reports, and the targets have been set for the 5 years that we have. We have made some good progress in the last financial year, especially with regards to disability recruitment. Although we didn't meet our target of 2%, we improved on the previous 0.9 to 1.75. Moving to the next slide, 39, here it's dealing with how do we build and maintain an integrated and service-oriented cutting-edge IT system. Again, two projects we bring to your attention here, and that's dealing with firstly the IT network. And our target here very much is to ensure that all our sites are covered and are online for over 95% time. And we have by and large met this target. The next slide deals with how do we maintain our hardware and software applications. Again, our target is talking about availability of the software and applications to meet our business need, as well as IT hardware platform that also meets business need. And you would find that very much our targets are very high, over 99% availability of our servers, as well as the software and applications availability. And by and large, we have met that in the last financial year, and we aim to ensure that this continues. I'll now hand you back to the CFO, who will take us through the budget. Thanks.
Now, dealing with the budget, indicated earlier the main source of Legal Aid SA's revenue is the grant. We received 1.9 billion of the grant. That was supplemented by the 20 million from interest that we receive from funds that we don't need immediately, and a small insignificant amount that we get for proceeds from disposal of used up assets or contributions from client contributions. I mean, contributions from clients that contribute to us. Again, it's very, very insignificant, under 500,000. Okay, when we prepared the budget for 2019-20, we considered the following: Legal Aid SA strategic plan, which is now coming to an end. We will be busy with the new one. We took into account National Treasury's allocation. The new allocation having reversed the 5% budget cut. The proportion of the direct service delivery costs to the support costs. We took into account the capital asset replacement program, and we looked at the liquidity ratios, if we can still fund some of Legal Aid SA service delivery from our existing cash reserves. The table indicates the government grant over the 7-year period. For the period under review, 2019-20, our grant is now 1.97 billion. This was after the reversal of the budget cut, which was from 1.863 to 1.97. You note that it has grown over the period from 1.5 in 2015-16 and to just under 2 billion now. Okay, a large portion of our budget, if we look at it in terms of our balance scorecard, it goes to client, community, stakeholder, and shareholder.
Sorry, can you speak to the mic?
Okay. Thank you. Okay. The large portion, which is 72%, it goes to our client and community. That's the core service delivery of our organization. That is followed by the employee and OC, which is the support and includes all the salary and related costs for our support employees. And two smaller portions go to finance, sustainability, and the internal business processes. So if we analyze our budget year on year when comparing it to 2018-19, overall it has grown by 5.9%. This is after taking into account for salaries, that 7.1% is after taking into account the cost of living increases and the PPI. The direct expenditure, move on to the next slide, okay, that grew by 19.1%. This was due to the increase in duty care and the impact litigation. The duty care is where we outsource the legal services to external legal service providers. So it increased there because we were reversing the budgets of previous years. This was after National Treasury has given us the 95.6 back. Overall operating budget increased by only 3.6%. This, we were just capping the contractual obligation. The other operating expenditure, again due to limited resources, did not increase at the same rate as the CPI or the macro increase. The capital budget, it looks high at an increase of 70%. It's because it includes rollover funds from the previous financial year. But year on year, it increased at the relative rate of 5.6%. Okay. With National Treasury having reversed the budget cut, we still have a shortfall. A shortfall is caused by the difference between the macro increase, this is now the growth in the grants compared to the growth in the cost of living increase, because that one is always higher than the amount that we receive. That way we have to find ways to fund it from our existing allocation, because Treasury says all those increases have to be funded within the existing baseline. So over the 3-year period, the the, I'm looking at Roman figure 3. The budget shortfall was 371 million for that period. And that is funded by reviewing our, how we prepare our allocation within the existing line items. That's why you will note that the operating budget is increasing at a far lower rate, because we haven't been increasing that in order to be able to cover our fixed costs being salaries. The challenge is exhibit is brought about by the fact that salaries constitute 80% of our budget. So only 20% that remains is for CAPEX and for operating. So salaries are fixed costs, which, you know, we don't have any option but to apply the rates. Okay, the slide on slide 48 indicates the percentage of the shortfall and the budget. So in 2019, we still had that budget cut of 92 million, which together with the shortfall of 71, it was a 164 million, which is 8.8% of our budget cut. Following the reversal, we only had a small budget cut of 2.7 million for SMS salaries budget cut. But the shortfall of 82 million still existed, the shortfall between the CODI and the macro, resulting in a total shortfall of 85.5 million, which is 4.3%. And going forward, the shortfall grew in terms of CPI and the CODI, being 118 million. In total, we had a shortfall of 121 million, being 5.7% of the total budget. So as we currently preparing the MTF now for the years going forward, 2020-2021, in terms of the MTF guidelines, we need to make provision for the indicative budget cuts of 5, 6, and 7% for financial years 2021 and subsequent. So that, if implemented, will further make the situation worse.
Thanks, CFO. I'll deal with item slide number 50, dealing with the legal aid South Africa challenges. Chair, following up from the CFO's presentation, we are still experiencing budget cuts, as indicated, notwithstanding the reversal that took place last year. So a key challenge for us is the management of budget cuts, this would require us to look at every segment of our budget. That's legal and support, looking at direct expenditure, operating expenditure, and capital expenditure. So the main impacts of the budget cuts deals with how do we manage staff positions, and where we are reducing staff position, how does that impact in terms of our delivery program at courts, as well as our coverage of courts. So that will be explained a little later. In terms of non-salary budget items, we need to note that the operating budget constitutes about 20% of our total budget, as indicated. And over the last 3 years, the operating budget actually was reduced by 15%. If we look at over a 10-year span, our operating budget was reduced by 23%. So the key critical challenge is, how do we continue to support a legal services delivery program with an operating budget that is continuously being reduced? So there may not be enough support for the legal practitioners. It also has an impact on our constitutional obligations, specifically sections 34, 35, and 28 that our chairperson spoke about earlier, and whether we are going to be compromised in terms of the services we can render in order to meet our constitutional obligations. Budget cuts also have a huge impact in terms of the justice system. For information, we cover more than 70% of the matters in the lower court, and more than 80% of the matters in the High Court, so it's quite a significant proportion of the caseload Legal Aid South Africa is responsible for. And when we have to reduce staff, then our coverage becomes lesser, and this impacts negatively on the criminal justice system in particular. And important to note that where there's unequal resourcing of Legal Aid South Africa, as opposed to other sectors, it reinforces the inefficiency. It also has a negative impact on clients because their cases are now delayed and their rights to a speedy trial is also eroded. It also talks to the confidence in the justice system when the system itself doesn't function too well, especially when courts can't function because legal aid is not present. So it's a number of challenges that we experience in the current year because of budget cuts. I'll hand you over now to Mr. Lesevan, who will be in the last few slides. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair and Honourable Members. I'll just focus on slide 51 until the end. For the current financial year 2019 to 2020, there are a few areas that we want to focus on. We, in the probably at the end of the last five-year planning period, and we're going to be starting the next five-year planning period. So from 2019 to 2020, we should develop the new strategic plan. And secondly, the other focus area would be, as it has already been explained, to ensure that there is financial sustainability, as well as the delivery of quality service to our clients. And finally, obviously, we need to manage the impact of the budget cuts on our employees by ensuring that we still maintain and strengthen the current organizational culture of high performance, and also to ensure that we've got a leadership team that can actually lead this organization to achieve those objectives that have been shared with the committee. Way forward, on slide 53, it is our endeavor to ensure that Legal Aid remains a high-performance organization by way of increasing access to justice, realizing good audit outcomes, being able to be accredited as a top employer, and we've been doing this over the years as it has been shared with you. We also want to make sure that we continue to operate within the best governance framework to make sure that we're responsive, we're accountable, we're fair, we're transparent, participative, efficient, effective, and being economic. We also ensure that we maintain zero tolerance for fraud and malfeasance. We've been able to do this over the years through a culture that ensures that there's a strong work ethic, there's integrity and accountability for public funds, as been outlined. We obviously, as the mandate is clear for all of us to understand, we need to ensure that we continue to focus on the delivery of constitutional and our legislative mandates to improve access to justice and to build the maturity of Legal Aid South Africa to ensure its sustainability. Thank you so much, Chairperson and honourable members.
Thank you very much for the presentations. I will now give this opportunity to honourable members to interact with the presentation. Honourable Jele, Honourable Ngona, Honourable Olaudi, Honourable Glenis, Honourable Horn, Honourable Nivold Drechen.
Thank you, Chair. And also, let me thank the Legal Aid team for the good work that you are doing, and also for being a top employer. Those efforts are really noted, and your presentation is really encouraging, more so under the circumstances of these budget cuts. You know, Chairperson, one thing that comes out of all the reports about the budget cuts, one thing that is good that is coming out of that is that the teams are able to now think creatively and come up with ways of saving. In actual fact, the issue of the problems in terms of our economy in the country we all feel it. And we just want to thank the team for really working and doing a good job under the circumstances. I have some few questions that I would like to pose to the team. The first one is on the issue of staff. I just want to check with the legal aid that do you have an internship program in all you're doing in terms of the staff recruitment. Secondly, I just want to find out under what circumstances or which circumstances that where the team is pushed to an extent of getting the external experts to come and give run the services. Also, I just want to check, also Chairperson, how many of the board members that are back. I'll tell you why, because I'm just checking in terms of the retention, the experience. In fact, I'm pushed by the report, the good work that you have been doing, that maybe are we still going to continue to get that even the coming years without undermining anyone. Lastly, Chairperson, I just want to find out about the offices that you have, because I don't know, I've noted that most of your offices are still maintaining the positioning of the old special area, I don't know what you call it, how we were, you know, yes, divided. Is it possible that in future we have some of your offices closer to, I'll call it the township? Because I see some of them, you have one in Benoni, for example. When you check Benoni and you check the township, the very people that we want to help to render services to, they have to take taxis to access your services, and you find that it is also a problem for them. I think that was the last one, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. I think when we talk about townships, we must also talk about rural areas. Honorable Ngola.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let us, of course, welcome the presentation by the Legal Aid Board. Of course, we must stress it out that you are not appearing before the committee to be grilled, to be bent and bright. As the media may convey such perception, it has been doing that since last week throughout. But what is important, Chair, is that we be given the true reflection of what is happening within legal aid as an institution, so that we are able to help where the necessity arises. So that we work together as the executive and the legislature to have a viable and better working legal aid. So that's why it is important to receive the truthful reflections of what is happening in any, in fact, institute that falls within our jurisdiction as this committee. I think, Chair, let us note with interest as public representatives that central to the mandate of legal aid is representing the indigent, the vulnerable, who which is a special group in the South African Populist Act. We as public representatives have a special affection unto. It's a very important structure of society that which we take very much serious. I think Chair will have just some few questions. Which is one, there is generally a lot of discontent around issues relating to the Master's office. You represent our people working with that office in issues like the administration of estates. How is your experience as legal aid when it relates to the Master's office and the administration of the estate of the poor and the vulnerable that which you represent? Chair, there is an issue of the threshold, which I think is very important. Let's say maybe 5,000 per annum. I'm making an example. That do we consider as legal aid that socio-economic situations of our people change? And if we do, do we consider to revisit our threshold, or it has been stagnant since our establishment as an institution? Has it been the same threshold, or it changes from time to time as in accordance to the needs of the general society? On the threshold as well, Chair, how do we apply the threshold in different scenarios like a certain Xola Xola who has been accused of having stolen a sheep who qualifies to be represented by legal aid? A certain Xola Xola who's facing a labor dispute in a certain local municipality. Do we consider even on that labor dispute that the pay slip of this employee for us to represent must reflect that particular threshold? Equally, when it comes to the civil matter, how do we then apply the general threshold that we have as the institution? There is, Chair, a number of actually a structure of staffing legal aid. Would like to get the reflection of how your staff is structured. We have candidate attorneys, we have admitted attorneys who deal with civil matters, we have senior counsels. Just that reflection, I may not be accurate with my example, but just that reflection of, so that we're able to test the actual capacity of legal aid in dealing with both minor and complex issues that are facing our own people. There is this part, Chair, that I think will need the Department of Justice to give us the correct answer. Remember yesterday, the Human Rights Commission said they received the smallest budget in the department. And I hear that even legal aid says they are receiving the smallest share. I think it's just the entire department that can preface with that. This is another thing, Chair, I want to get clarity on. Do we have a budget allocated for briefings to private practitioners? If so, how much is the budget and how is it counted? How do we arrive that this budget must be 100 rands? Secondary to that, Chair, do we have paralegals within our employees that which are responsible in mediating matters that we're faced with, even in a situation where they are not supposed to be actually taken to court. Some of the matters do not really need to take to be taken to court for them to reach a resolution. To have paralegals that are actually doing that work for the benefit of our people. There is again, Chair.
You must also bear in mind that there are also other hands.
Okay, Chair, I'm finishing up. Sorry. There is this phenomenon, Chair, that has become so common of the budget cut, budget constraints, and blah, blah, blah. I think we must, as the committee, check into it closely. We must check the underpinning factors to such effect. May it be the GDP, or what are the actual factors that are directed to this last decade? Do we have a budget that is allocated for legal costs? In an event where we lose costs, we don't get the order for costs in a court of law. Do we have a budget allocated for such? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chairperson, and let me congratulate you, the Chairperson of the Board, by this 17 unqualified audit reports from the institution since 2002. We know you are a new board. We'll appreciate for you to continue with this good work. Your new board mustn't come and collapse the system. So the first question which I wanted to know is about the staff. You said you have 2,750 staff complement. So maybe in writing, can you break down it so that we can see the equity in terms of women, youth, and people living with disability? That would be proper if you can do that in the next time. And on slide 42, you talk about the budget income of 20 million from the investment income. So maybe we would be happy if you can be opportune to know how much do you have in your investment, because this is sounds as an interest of 20 million maybe per annum, but out of how much and where did you invest this money? The other is about the intents, as the Honorable Maseko said. More especially, can you tell us how many interns, more especially the new lawyer, graduate lawyer student, are you assisting to this legal aid in South Africa? If we can get the numbers also per graduate in the institution, mostly focusing on the institution from the disadvantages universities. The other question which I want to get the clarity, remember this institution is an old institution which was there in terms of Act 22 of 1969, and which was replaced by Act 38, 2014. So I want to know your place where you are operating, because most of the places where I notice it's the Fifth Parliament, the legal aid South Africa rented the place. Do you have your own building, or do you think of buying your own building so that you can avoid these rentals unnecessary for the institution which is more than 40 years institution? So the other thing is about your outreach programs to the rural communities or disadvantaged areas and townships, because some of the poor people that don't know about this service. What is the outreach program? Do we have adverts in radios? How do you meet the people deep down on the rural area? So the other one is about the group life cover policy, which was emanated that there was a group life cover which was giving people from about 2 million for the member if the member passed on. Now it was reduced to 250,000, and it's like people and the workers and staff, they were discouraged and not comfortable. We just want to know from you how far on solving that matter, because there's another accusation against the Legal Aid South Africa about the intimidation to the staff not to demonstrate as they are allowed to do so by the Constitution. So we just want to know how true is that. And the other thing is about what we did in the Fit Parliament. We refused the proposal for budget cut, and the Treasury promised that they won't cut, they will add another financial resources to the Legal Aid. We just want to know whether that happened or not, or the Treasury, did they cut the budget for 2019-2020 budget and 2020 to 2021, or vice versa, did they add some funds, because this is the service which needed most for the poor people, for fairness of justice. Lastly, Chairperson, is about the last time the Legal Aid was complaining that there are some staff they will need to cut them, sort of retrenchment. We just want to know whether to cover the shortfall budget. Did that happen? There are some people who lost their jobs because of the budget shortfall or not. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you. Honorable Plainness, Fredenbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was covered by my colleague, so I'm fine. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honorable Horn.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Just a few questions following from the presentation. Firstly, the role of Legal Aid South Africa in the National Efficiency Enhancement Committee and the various Provincial Efficiency Enhancement Committee. If I understand the presentation correctly, there is only one meeting of the National Efficiency Enhancement Committee per year, or Legal Aid South Africa is only involved in one per year. So firstly, I want to hear whether, in their view, one meeting of the National Efficiency Enhancement Committee is enough, and if not, whether they've tried to amend the situation. We know from the presentations by the Office of the Chief Justice that there is now to be compiled quarterly reports in this regard. So I don't completely understand how one is to have quarterly reports from the different divisions but only one meeting per year. And then secondly, Chair, the one thing that was a bit of an issue last year in terms of governance or financial performance was that 84% of the Judicare invoices were not paid within 30 days, and there was an explanation that it was due to some system issues, so it would be good to just get an update as to what the situation is now. And linked to that, previously, and I believe still as a target, only 3% of the either the work or the budget is spent on Judicare, those private practitioners who assist Legal Aid. But from the presentation, I gather that this was expanded as of late. So if we could get a percentage of what percentage of the work and the budget set aside for Legal Aid assistance is now spent on duty care assistance by private practitioners. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome, Honorable Mohammed. We did receive your apology, Honorable Newbold Strachan.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you to Legal Aid for your presentation, and congratulations on the Best Employer Award that you also received. I want to go to slide 38, equity targets. It says 1.5 increase to 1.75 for disability. Now, I want to know how many warm bodies is that 1.75? How many warm bodies, and then your toll-free line that you can call Legal Aid. I'm wondering if this includes an SMS, a plain SMS, or an email. Obviously, deaf people can't call unless it's through a sign language interpreter, but if they want to directly contact you, is there a facility available for them to SMS or email? I'm becoming more and more worried about the access to the justice system or access to the judicial services for the deaf, because sign language interpreters are not available. I had an opportunity, previously I was a social worker, before I came to Parliament, to bring some deaf people to Legal Aid, and deaf people can only come to Legal Aid if a social worker comes with or a sign language interpreter is available, but the deaf person themselves need to bring the interpreter most of the time. So now with that, the second thing is also within court. Many deaf people are at court, maybe involved in criminal activities or as a victim of crime, but the court delays it because they don't appoint sign language interpreters or they are not aware that the person who is coming before them is deaf. Now, how is Legal Aid assisted with that? What was the assistance? Can it be greater in future and offer more assistance to ensure that legal services are also accessible for people with different disabilities? So how possibly in the future, even if it wasn't in the past, but how in the future can you assist in this regard? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Honorable Mohammed, I know you came late. I just wanted to check if you have certain questions to ask.
Yeah, just a short one. Thank you very much, Jay. My apologies again. Just a cursory bouncing through the report. Thank you for a very informative slide and presentation, as I just had a cursory look at it. But just something fundamental which affects a lot of people, millions for that matter. We understand your mandate is quite wide in terms of the constitution. In the budget, you have to do much more with very little, and that's understood. And despite that, congratulations also from our side with regard to your 17 NFQs, as well as the clean orders noted. We know a lot of effort goes into that. Repeatedly, as you have done. Just on the matter which is of concern is Section 28 of the Constitution, as well as your amendment to provide and represent children in civil matters. In line with my colleague already asked about the threshold, but let me just zoom into that. The children, how far do you take the mandate? Because children is not only children in conflict with the law, as we know, but it's also children in care in terms of the Child Justice Act, or the Children's Act for that matter. Children is affected by also divorces or domestic violence, right? And not necessarily direct, only in conflict with the law. Now, on your civil matters, in my notes, your $1.9 billion budget, it seems the Constitution gives equal parity or cognizance of both Section 35 to Section 35.3 as well as 28.1. Now we know you have got a policy for the indigent, with a certain threshold. But what measure do you take to determine the accused in criminal matters would be the primary operation of the legal aid? How do you get to that? What's the determining factor? I'm obviously asking that because whether it's a policy matter, but certainly constitutionally, children have the same effect. So when we talk about women last year in aid of a criminal divorce or domestic violence matter for that, where I come in my previous work, there are thousands, and we know your efforts in trying, but it's almost, by the way, if we can, we will help you. And in the middle strata, we can't afford legal representation, despite this imminent threat to life, both to single mothers as well as children, very little is allocated. You can comment on that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Over to you, Judge Makombe and the team.
Thank you, sir. The questions will be answered by most of the management exco, but wherever possible, some of the board members will also chip in. I could just quickly answer the issue about the deaf and dumb. It's a problem about interpretation. This morning when we visited our Belleville office, I posed a question to our practitioners, how do they cope with the issue about the fact that most of the staff do not know Xhosa, others only speak Afrikaans and all those things. So what we ended up doing is that we, by agreeing is that all, that we need to start an effort that legal practitioners themselves should be able to know the language of the client. And I informed them that some years ago in the law societies, we had started discussing with the universities that right at a second year LLB level or third year, law students should start learning the language of the area where they're going to practice. It will make it much easier. So we think we should start thinking about that. So that will cover the specialist issues like learning how to speak, to communicate with the deaf and dumb. The issue of communication or interpretation in the country is becoming very serious. We're having to provide, the Department of Justice has to provide for interpretation for accused persons from almost all of Africa because of the influx of people who have come into the country. You won't mind to know that when we listen to cases of accused persons from Zimbabwe, and they'll tell you that there are 7 dialects, for instance, in Mozambique or that, and this one, I don't speak that type of Shona. The type of Shona is the following one. So the Department of Justice must provide that. And as far as I know, in Gauteng, we struggle to get interpreters. So it's a very serious thing that has been raised. And I think together, we are not only ones, the Department of Justice, together with the universities and ourselves, should get together and see how we cover such issues. Thank you. The rest of the questions, I'm sure, will be answered.
Okay, Chairperson. I will try and respond to the questions, and my colleagues will assist me. And also, there are some questions which require some data, and that we'll provide in writing to the committee secretary following this meeting. So as far as the issue of staff and internship programs is concerned, of the staff that we have, over 2,500, as I indicated, about 80% of them are legal staff and paralegals, and then the question related to internship. So our main internship component of our employees is the candidate attorneys that we employ. So we employ graduate lawyers, and they have to go through a training period, and that period is changing now in terms of the new Legal Practice Act. But they are employed by us for a period of between 1 and 2 years. And we employ, at any one time, we are actually probably the largest employer of legal graduates. And we provide that access to the profession to them, and we have about 600 of them. So each year we take about 300 because generally they are spending 2 years with us. So that is the main intern program we have. But secondly, we also have, working with different bodies, sometimes CETA, sometimes others, interns in terms of like maybe for auditors, our internal audit,
or in terms of communications, etc. But those are very small, like really a handful. Our main intern program is which is our core business anyway, which is legal services, so it's lawyers. In terms of the Judicare, I think there was a question on Judicare and how much and who we, what we spend and what kind of expertise we get on that. I think that our Judicare, we in terms of the number of matters that we do, and I can give you the figures for the budget separately out of this meeting, but in terms of the numbers, it is still correct that we're doing less than 5%. So about 3 to 4% of our work is done through Judicare attorneys or counsel, and that is in terms of numbers of legal matters. And that of those, in terms of expertise, the question was what was the expertise that we get? And I think that in generally we're using Judicare in matters in higher courts or in matters where there are more than one accused, so we need to have them represented separately when there's conflicts of interest. And in some instances there's the issue of expertise. As far as expertise is concerned in our own staff, we have built up expertise especially in criminal matters over the years. And we have different lawyers and different requirements for each court type. So for the district courts, to the regional courts, to the high courts, there's different levels of requirement and training that is required and experience. And on average, people stay with legal aid. So for example, our turnover rate is less than 6% per annum, which means that on average, our lawyers have been with legal aid and many of the, if you look at the number of years of legal experience, is now well over 10 years. So in that way, we've built up expertise in different categories ourselves, and that's how we are able to assist. But in terms of the actual issue of the Judicare, we are getting them not only in terms of capacity on expertise, but also when there's conflicts of interest. And because there's such a small number, it would be in a small number of matters, as we said. It's less. It's about 3 to 4% of our 350,000 legal matters that we would use Judicare. In terms of our board, 5 out of the 10 board members are new and 5 are old. So we ensured continuity. Judge Makume and Mr. Leselani are both were in the previous board. Ms. Advocate Udayan is a new member. So in that way, we were doing exactly that. We want to ensure that there's continuity, and so we are confident that that will be addressed. We agree that in terms of the apartheid spatial planning and the apartheid city notion, that the location of offices and services is important. Historically, the legal aid offices have been located closer to courts, and the reason for that is because 80% of our work is related to court work. And that is where, again, we haven't achieved as much as we can in terms of being in the townships or in the rural areas to the extent we need to. But we do have to link it to court, which then reduces the travel time for our lawyers. But we are in townships and we are also in rural areas, especially in the rural areas in our satellite offices, where satellite offices are smaller, like almost a branch of a main office, but they don't have the full management capacity there. And many of those are in the more remote areas. So I think that we're trying to find the balance, and we would then be part of the department or the justice cluster in looking at how to improve them. Specifically on our side, we would try to ensure that our offices are located closer to the transport nodes. So even if they may not be actually where people live, they are at places where they can be accessed so that they're not out of. Because the civil clients are the only clients that access us at our offices, as we explained, that makes up 13%. In terms of the issue of the issue of master's office and our experience, I think that and linking to civil, I'll get Patrick to respond to that in a moment. As far as the issue of the means test, yes, we did explain that just in last year we increased the means test for the very reason that we've got to respond to changing context and changing socioeconomic needs, and we have to balance that with the budget that we have. So we want to reach as many people, but we also want to reach, we want to be able to do more with the money we have. When we do that, we do the research and we check, for example, what are the subsidies that are being provided by the Department of Social Development or Department of Housing, etc. So we try and look at all of that, and that's what we did last year. And we will look at it periodically, and that's also what the Parliament Committee had asked us to keep a check on that. So yes, we just did increase it, and we will continue to track it. We did talk about the issue of staffing in terms of the, you said the nature of staff, I explained, and the type of staff we have. We have different levels of staff for the different levels of courts, and then we have separate civil practitioners, and then we have some who are doing the strategic litigation work that Patrick mentioned as one of our programs. In that we would have more senior lawyers who are specializing in that kind of work, and that's really a small number, and like we know that senior counsel anyway are small numbers. So we don't have names, we don't use the names, the NPA does, I know, use some of those labels, but we don't. We just link it to the levels of complexity of the matters that we do. But what I'm clarifying is that we don't just have one kind of lawyer that can do any work anywhere in legal aid. It's the kind of work that, it's kind of matter that comes to us that we would then link the legal practitioner to that. As far as the issue of the smallest share, yeah, just to clarify, of the budget, when I was saying it, I was meaning it in terms of the justice cluster and the entities, not the Chapter 9. SA, Human Rights Commission and Public Protector are Chapter 9, and they do get less than us. I'm not disputing it. But they are doing a separate role from ours, and in terms of where we are reaching the general public in terms of the services, legal aid services, their role is slightly different. So when we're comparing, that's just to clarify that matter. The budget for Judicare, I've clarified that, and I'll give the actual figures, but it links to that 3-4% of the work. Paralegal work, Patrick will clarify that, but they won't do work that is reserved for lawyers. They only do advice work, but he'll clarify anything further. As far as the issue of the budget constraints and the budgets in terms of allocated to legal costs, Patrick will clarify that in civil matters we don't take on legal costs of losses, but again he can talk to that a bit more. We will provide the further data on the employment equity, which is what was requested, separately, because that's the figures. And as far as the issue of staffing concern, I think that you would have read in the media, which is linked to the question that was raised about our staff being unhappy about the reduction in the employee benefits. Now, Chair, you would know that in the context of budget constraints, we have to balance our budget and we have to make choices in terms of various things. So essentially, we were cutting, as was indicated in the slide, we were cutting our budget across all segments. So we weren't only cutting staff stuff. We were cutting everything, including other operating costs. And in the end, we had to also identify areas where we could cut further. And so for that, we did balance the issue of cutting some employee benefits at the expense of cutting jobs, which would affect warm bodies, but would also affect people. Warm bodies, but would also affect services, because it means if we employ less people, then it means we can deliver less services. So that was the trade-off. And in that context of trade-off, yes, we did reduce employee benefits, and the reality is that everyone has to do that. And I think employees will always want to ensure that their individual interests are protected. Our responsibility as management and the board is to ensure that the organizational interests are protected, and that we are sustainable and we continue to be able to do the work. And no, we dispute and deny any issue of intimidation. We actually worked with the employees and we clarified that, yes, they were. I received the memo personally when the employees came to deliver the memo. So we don't believe in that. As an organization that protects the rights of others, we wouldn't. We don't have to resort to that. We disagree in terms of what the employees might want because we can't afford it, but as in the end they have a right, the democratic right and the constitutional right, as was said, to have protest. So that is not an issue, and I can assure the committee that we wouldn't do it. Rebecca will clarify investment income, which is actually where we have our cash. As the Treasury allocates cash to us and we put it in interest-bearing accounts, it's more that. We're not allowed to have other investments, but she'll say where that is kept. I've addressed the issue of interns. And the places where we are operating, yes, we have 128 plus 6 provincial offices plus our national offices. That's 135 sites at which we operate across the country. And of those, less than 10 are properties that we own. I think the ownership of properties brings its own challenges, but we did try that as one of the options to reduce the rental costs. And where we have funds, we will still look into that. But generally, at the moment, we don't have any funds. But we do have that, just to clarify in terms of what we do have. I've addressed the issue of the group life. In terms of the issue of the reduction, I know that many members who were in the committee in the previous parliament and supported us, and we thank you for that, in terms of saying that in the budget cuts should be re-looked at because of the fact that our services are reaching the poorest people and the vulnerable persons. And I think it's because of that, as well as because, and so it's representations from the committee, as well as representations from the ministry, from the board, as well as our good track record of having sound financial management and delivery that, as we explained in the slides, National Treasury, we did have the 5% cut last year, but for this financial year, which is 2019-20, they reversed the 5% cut to the baseline, which was very good news for us, which meant that we then didn't have to reduce the staffing. And so we only have the shortfall, which is what the CFO was explaining. So in total, where we would have had about a 9% cut to our budget, the 5% was taken away, so we still had the 4%. So that was what we clarified. With that, we then means we still had to reduce. Did anybody lose jobs? Yes, when we were talking about it last time, it was in relation to that 9% cut that we would have had to reduce warm bodies. But in the end, no one lost jobs at Legal Aid because of the reversal. And that it means that currently what we are trying to do is manage in terms of managing our vacancies and freezing posts when we have reductions. However, in the new period, I know that National Treasury has given guidelines and has required us to also plan for budget cuts in the next MTEF period, right, which is not this year but some next year, which could also be 5%. So if that comes on stream, then definitely it will mean that we will have to reduce posts, and it could mean some persons will be affected because of the fact that, as we've explained, a very small part of our budget is actually the operating budget. A large part is salaries, which means that whatever happens, our salaries always get affected. And that's where we will then have to look at that. But that is still it hasn't been confirmed. It is what they say we must plan for. I think I'll stop there, and I'll just ask Brian to just respond to questions that I might have missed, and then Patrick and Rebecca, Chairperson.
Also, if you can link the issue of the Judicare with the issue of the prison patterns.
Okay.
Because there has always been a problem, especially by the bar and the sidebar, with regards to prison patterns, generally of the previously disadvantaged and the lawyers. If you can have information.
Yes, Brian will clarify that. Brian.
Thanks, Chairperson. Maybe that's a very specific way to start is on Judicare. CEO did mention about the quantum of Judicare. Plus minus between 3% and 5%. On average, the budget for Judicare is just over 70 million, but we do have a program in place that where we have vacancies and and budget is not used for salaries, then that savings is transferred to Judicare so that service delivery can proceed. So over the last few years, we could have spent plus minus 100 million on Judicare, so it's quite a substantial amount, although the number of matters may not be appropriate. We have an accreditation system where lawyers will have to accredit in order to get a Judicare. And we have a system in place in which, depending on the type of work that a Judicare practitioner wants to engage in, whether it's high court work or lower court, civil or criminal, as well as their experience levels. If it's a newly qualified practitioner, he will be confined to work in the district courts. More than 5 years, they will get work in the regional courts and with a required level of ICON experience, we can get ICON litigation. Our system is designed in such a way that we try to reduce human element in appointing, The system looks at a particular criteria for the allocation of work. We follow very much the current BEE principles in terms of allocating a practitioner based on the BEE ratings. Okay, so each one gets a ranking, and depending on when they fall in the top four rankings, then they get the instruction. But it's actually aligned more or less perfectly with the BBB legislation currently. So the only problem is that in terms of the distribution of practitioners, three quarters of the accredited practitioners are male and a quarter of the practitioners are female. So what we have done is the board has taken a decision which we will implement as soon as our new system is in place, and that is we want to give a greater weighting to women so that they get more instructions, and it will be an incentive to firms to employ women practitioners because there's a potential for more instructions to women. There was also another question on duty care, that is, it was mentioned that 85% of our matters or accounts are paid after 30 days. In fact, I think it's just got it wrong. In the last financial year, we paid about 85% of the accounts within 30 days. But still, 15% was above 30 days. There are various issues relating to that, which includes the accounts are not all the documentation required may not be in place. We have put very stringent implementations in place in terms of addressing that issue. I can tell you for quarter one of this year, the payment rate moved up to 98.5%. So we have made some good strides in terms of ensuring that almost all our practitioners are paid. In fact, I can say to the committee that more than 80% of the paid within 14 days of them submitting an account to our office. If I can move on to the first, the questions raised by the first honourable member dealing with experts, when do we actually use external experts in terms of our work? I wasn't sure whether you were referring to judicare practitioners, but I think we covered that adequately. But I can also assure the committee that all our lawyers are independently allowed to make a decision on whether they require an expert to assist them in the conduct of the case. So if they need a psychologist or a clinical psychiatrist to advance a particular legal angle, then they need to source the required quotations via our in terms of our supply chain policy, and then they can make the motivation. And depending on the cost, there's various approval limits, approval persons who can grant it. So we don't limit our practitioners in terms of the conduct of the case, experts that they require. Moving on to Patrick will deal with the Master's Office. In terms of the threshold that was there, CEO did mention the threshold. Yes, it was changed last year, and we hope to review whether the threshold is appropriate more often. But I need to indicate that the main stress is just but one means of assessing whether a person qualifies for legal aid. Okay, so at the moment the limit is 7,400 for an individual person. Okay, but we do look at the type of matter in which a person is currently accused of, and we consider whether that person would be able to afford the cost of a legal practitioner on an ongoing basis. And where we come to a conclusion that the person will not be able to afford that cost, then the option is available to us to grant legal aid subject to a contribution. And our policy documents do give guidelines in terms of what the contribution would be that the accused will, or the client will need to provide to us. So it is possible. For instance, in the Buruma case, there were doctors who were qualifying for legal aid because they would not have been able to afford from their own pockets the cost of a lawyer for many years litigation. It's not possible. So we do look at that scenario as well. In terms of staffing, CEO alluded to the fact that we do have different levels of staffing. So if an accused falls in a district court, then our entry-level practitioners, including cabinet attorneys who have been court-prepared, are able to represent them. But our requirement for the regional court is a practitioner with at least 5 years' court experience. In the High Court, it's 7 years' court experience with 5 years' High Court experience if it's someone from the outside. So, and the same with civil, and Patrick will deal with that. So we do have those different categories of practitioners. Moving on to the role of the NEEC and PEEC, I think Honourable Owen asked this question. just to assure you that in terms of the target, the NEC, the national structure, is scheduled to meet twice a year. Unfortunately, last year only one meeting took place. The other meeting was not held, so therefore we reported on one. We don't think two is an unreasonable number on a biennial basis to have such a big meeting of the leadership of the different entities within the justice cluster. Because the more important committee is the provincial efficiency enhancement committees, and they meet every quarter. They look at very much the operational issues as it affects the courts. And we report on meetings held, which we actually ensure 100% attendance at all stages. I can assure the committee that also we participate in the local committees. We call them case flow committees for which was previously one. And that is held maybe monthly in some cases or quarterly in some other cases. So the rollout of those meetings in terms of getting stakeholders together who operate within the court environment to deal with efficiency, obstacles, etc., we think is adequate at the moment. The only thing is when a meeting is scheduled, it would be good if it's held. Otherwise, we'd have the state of one meeting per year. In terms of the equity targets, we'll have to provide that separately. I did say that it increased from 0.9% to 1.75% of the year. I can't work out the numbers quickly, but I would imagine it must be plus minus about 50 individuals if we look at the 1.75. But we can provide that figure separately. I think I'll pause at this stage. Patrick can deal with the issues dealing with civil and call center and the masters.
I'm sorry, before he does that, there was a question about do you advertise on radio only or what? I think that question will be answered. But one of the things that I also wanted to add as regards judicare services is that much as we try to involve many judicare services, we have problems with practitioners not being tax compliant. So it delays payment or they do not get accredited because most of them do not want to raise their SARS to pay tax. So in terms of our system, they cannot be included in terms of our CSD program. So, yeah.
Thank you, Chair. I'll move on to the issue relating to discontent and the issues with the Master's Office. So generally, Legal Aid South Africa doesn't do administration of estates, save that we've got an agreement with the Master's Office that we will assist and do administration of estates where it involves minor children. Because the difficulty that has been found is that where you've got smaller estates that are below 250,000 rand, there's an informal process where you appoint someone to receive and to distribute it. Sometimes when you appoint someone, a family member, you find that the monies disappear. So we protect the interests of minor children so that we collect those monies. We will divide it amongst, and sometimes there are adults that are beneficiaries as a result of that, but we protect the interests of our minors and ensure that those monies are paid across into the Guardian's Fund. And then the Guardian's Fund will administer those funds. Just to give you an indication, we get in about, last year we paid across to the Guardian's Fund about 51 million rand for minor children that we had collected in the year. At any one time we're having about 60 million rand in our trust account, which mostly links to estates for minor children. We have a very close relationship with the Master's Office, so if we have any issues or hiccups, we have regular meetings with them, at least quarterly. If there's an issue that we can't deal with, I've got the Acting Chief Master's number, we'll phone, we'll discuss, and we'll deal with issues. Sometimes there are difficulties, but it's nothing that we are not able to overcome. The cooperation between us and the Master's Office is good. So I think from that, you must remember any estate above 250,000 requires a formal appointment of an administrator, and normally that person has to give security for the proper administration of the estate, and that is mostly done by attorneys and or banks. So it's not the Master's Office task to administer estates. They're there merely to regulate and make sure that the estate and that whoever's doing it does that work properly. They will not be involved in helping anyone to administer their estate. So I'm not too sure if that answers the question, but it's not their responsibility on that, and normally that's then outsourced in terms of the Administration of Estates Act to attorneys, banks, and various institutions that then administer estates, specifically those that are above
250,000. Legal Aid South Africa, most of ours are limited to 250,000, but it doesn't mean sometimes that we don't larger estates, because sometimes the family don't know what is in the estate, and that's where we would go and investigate and find out. And you sometimes find there's policies there that pay out R1 million, and then you've got R1 million in, and but that has to come through various structures to approve that we then assist in some of those larger estates, or we will get the master then to appoint someone to administer that, those larger estates, because it falls then outside the mandate that's set for us in terms of the regulations from Parliament perspective. I hope that answers the issue on the master's office. Threshold in terms of what's been said in terms of the means test, I want to clarify. So for an individual it's 7,400. For a household it's 8,000. The CEO explained the process. But we also, in terms of the regulations, there is a discretion. Well, maybe let me say this firstly. We don't only look at income, we also look at assets. The reason why we do that is you have some people that have lots of money in trusts and then want to come and say legal aid must fund it. And we've had it in a case where we went all the way to the SEA to say, no, he doesn't live the lifestyle of someone that says he's earning this amount of money because he's got a trust that has a working dairy farm valued at R270 million. And those are the things that we deal with. And so that's why we look not only on your income, we also look at your assets. Assets we allow if you have only movable property up to R128,000, and then if you have immovable property and a house that's linked to that, we allow you up to R600,000. But apart from those, there are discretions. Then both to our local offices, who have a discretion on the income up to R1,500, so if you're sitting at R8,000, they can authorize up to R9,500 if they feel someone's going to suffer substantial prejudice. The regional head also has a further discretion in terms of income up to R3,000 to exceed the means test, and then in terms of assets to exceed it by R100,000. If anyone goes beyond that, it still can come to national office, and we have a committee at national office that will then consider these bigger matters where someone exceeds, and that's where the contributions policy then kicks in on the criminal side. On the civil side, most of them would come to my office to consider then, in the circumstances, do we assist someone, particularly it's women where there's children involved. You then have to, in terms of the regulations, give them sympathetic consideration, but you have to then look at their merits and the other factors within the income framework. So I think that, just to clarify overall in terms of the thresholds and the means test. Paralegals, so at each office we have paralegals. Yes, and the paralegals will get involved sometimes in resolving disputes. Normally it's one-on-one between different people. I've had instances where it's been father and daughter, where we've had paralegal mediating between them. So the possibility of mediation is they have been trained. So our training programs for our paralegals on how to do this, also from a legal empowerment perspective, we've got the Northwest University who focus a lot on training paralegals generally, but we've also used them from our training program to upskill our paralegals in these different aspects to be able to assist. In terms of the issue of costs on civil matters, so on civil matters, we must distinguish costs. If you're successful, you can recover costs from the other party. And yes, the only way where that happens is that we're able to recover costs. For example, now, in the first silicosis matter of Blom, we're recovering about R11 million from the gold mines. That's the first matter. It's not the second matter. So that bill, we're just in the process of agreeing and settling it. So we do recover costs. Whether if we act on behalf of somebody, Legal Aid South Africa, and let's say we are unsuccessful in the case, Legal Aid South Africa doesn't cover those costs and pay them. It is the client that still always remains liable in terms of those costs. And that's one of the issues we warn clients about in one of our forms and undertakings, that they understand that risk. But that's what's also important from a legal aid perspective. We don't take on civil matters where we feel they are not sufficient merits. And so that link into that. I'll do that. Thanks, Peter. So outreach programs, I think in terms of that, there's different ways in terms of where we do outreach. So we have from our communications department, there's outreach there. So communications will reach out, obviously on television, on radio, although you find television is quite expensive. And we see it from our perspective on the call center. When we're on television, the call volumes do increase. Once we go off, it goes down. So there we've tested also the model of putting our call center, the toll-free number and the please call me number on the back of matchboxes. So it's just, and we did see an increase on that, but obviously that has, obviously the costs involved with it, television is expensive. We also do have a large program in terms of radio, and specifically community radio, and a lot of it, some of it we pay for adverts, some of it is where our practitioners go on and discuss different topics on community radios. So we have a program in terms of that outreach, so that people understand their rights, and also where they can go to enforce their rights. From a communication perspective, we also have outreach programs, whether to taxis, pension paid points, where our staff are just telling them about the services as Legal Aid South Africa offer. So that's the one element which is more from a communications perspective on outreach. Then the other side of the outreach is on our paralegals, mostly linking to our satellite offices, where we require them to go to outreach points. They've got to identify them at least twice in a week. So sometimes it would be courts, it could be clinics, it could be even at pension pay points, although that sometimes is a bit difficult because SASSA doesn't want to tell you where they have those, although that's also, you know, changing where they do the pension payments, so that they go out to these places where people are able to reach them. And also sometimes courts. You find that people come to courts when they've got an issue, and then so we make sure that the courts give us a room, that we're there on a set day, that people know that we're going to be there on the set day, and the court can tell them that they must come on that day when we're going to be there. So we require the paralegals to go out and move away just from the offices. And I think it's something that we should also look at, is how do we reach with traditional authorities and chiefs where we can come to out there as well. And I think that's something where we need to look at to extend that outreach a bit further. Sorry, Chair, I'm just trying to see that I haven't missed the toll-free and SMS. So the toll-free, in terms of calls, we do have a system where they can send a please call me, but obviously that's not going to help in the situation where someone needs an interpreter and a sign language interpreter. So there we do have on our website is where if you want assistance, you can go on the website and you can type in your request for assistance, and that request for assistance does go through to our call center, that they're able to do it, and therefore they would be able to assist them and respond via that system on the please assist me. But I think the difficulty in terms of, and if it was to say that it would be easier via email, we would be able to then do that via email, because all our paralegals in the call center have access to emails and would be able to do it via email. I think in terms of sign language interpreters, there is a challenge, and I think the difficulty is when a client presents at the office, we don't have generally sign language interpreters. You can't have 128 offices somebody immediately available. So therefore it is easier if the client says, I can provide some assistance, someone can help me. It makes it easier. If we have to procure those services, then we've got to follow the supply chain management processes, and we've got a database in terms of different languages, which would also include sign language interpreters that we go to. But if we have to procure those services, we've got to go through the three-quote system, and so therefore it will cause a delay where someone's not able to maybe assist us and bring someone themselves. So in that way, I think we do seek the client's help in times that they do come. It's not something that we can't then procure, but that then obviously has to follow our procurement processes. Then the last question is our mandate and the issue relating to children and Section 28(1)(h) and those related issues. Obviously, children is a priority focus area. As we mentioned in this last financial year, we did 53,000 legal representation cases in civil matters. 57% of that linked to women. particularly. I think that number needs to be higher. But a lot of that is also linked then to family-related issues, which includes domestic violence and maintenance. The reality is, though, in terms of our limited resources, and if we look at maintenance-related issues and we look at domestic violence and just the statistics coming out of the Department of Justice, we're talking at least 250,000 new maintenance cases a year that complaints are laid at the Department of Justice. And there's a similar number in terms of domestic violence and in terms of the Harassment Act, although the statistics, only 83% of the magistrate's offices reported via the department's electronic system, and their stats showed about 220,000. Now, if you understand the capacity that Legal Aid South Africa has of about 50,000, 53,000 cases a year, it's impossible for us to, with the current resourcing, to address that demand. And you must accept most people going to maintenance court most probably will not be able to afford their own legal representation. So we've had to put criteria, and you'll see in the regulations, the criteria will assist someone in a maintenance matter, one, if they have merits, and two, if the other party is legally represented, or if they, in a period of a year, have not been able to obtain a maintenance order or enforce a maintenance order. So we've had to put those criteria in so that we can help those that have a particular problem. The same thing goes on domestic violence. If the other person is legally represented, they have merits in their defense, we will then also provide representation in domestic violence. I can say domestic violence at this moment, at stage, represents about 4% of the civil work that we do based on that criteria. Chair, I think that's, I hope you have responded to all the questions from the civil side.
Okay, thanks, Chair. I'll just respond to the one question relating to the investment income. So we would receive our grant from National Treasury. It would come in tranches on a monthly basis. We don't use this money all at once because we don't have to use it out. So what we do, we then invest it with the CPD, Corporation for Public Deposits. That's the Reserve Bank. We're required to deposit all our excess cash with the Reserve Bank. So we don't invest any funds with the commercial banks. We only use commercial banks for operational reasons. So the cash that was available as at year end was 260 million. So this cash is available to settle our creditors as and when they fall due. So it's not like it's spare cash that we don't need or we don't have any purpose for. Because in terms of the financial frameworks, we're required to make provision for, say, leave days or provision for judicare creditors where work has been done but they have not submitted invoices yet, or there's leave days due to staff, which if they resign or they leave, we need to have cash available to pay them out. Fortunately, it's unlikely that the organization will close in the foreseeable future that we have to use all this cash up at once. But because of the financial reporting framework, I need to make sure that I have made sufficient provision for all my creditors. So on a monthly basis, we would then receive interest from these funds that are with the Reserve Bank. Therefore, we use them to supplement our budget because over a period, we have a history as to how much we're likely to get based on the balance as at a particular period. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. I will allow, there's a request for follow-ups, not more than 1 minute.
Thank you, Chair. Just a special request, in terms of technology getting better and better every day and more people, including deaf people, using cell phones, please look into, please call, including SMS, so you can, we ourselves can send messages when we need legal services. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other follow-up? None. Can we just answer? In fact, it's not a question, it's a request that needs to be considered.
Chair, I think it's something from our side, and maybe it's we can look at how we can use WhatsApp or have a WhatsApp number that someone can use WhatsApp to communicate with us. And I think, you know, in terms of the use of technology, there's always some good ideas, and so we we learn and we can look at implementing. And I've also been thinking that if we just make an email address straight into the call center available in addition to that request on our website, that we can then make, and we'll look at that.
I think one of the areas that you can look into is a partnership with the Department of Communications. Now, in fact, the GCIS, they have a studio that is linked to all the community radios throughout the country. So maybe you can use that studio to do your outreach and to contact all the community radios throughout the country. It will work out cheaper for the organization. No, thank you very much. I think it's a very good report. It shows that a lot of work is being done. We are all faced with this challenge of budget cuts. We will continue to fight the good cause to ensure that it does not it's not that deep that it makes the organization not to be functional. But if you look at the last quarter, the performance of our economy was not good, and that has an impact on the budget. But it's important to consider what Member Maseko Jaila raised, that this calls upon all of us to be very creative in the use of public resources and to focus on areas where there will be maximum impact for the least budget used. No, but we are very happy with the kind of work that you do. And Judge, can you please convey our message of welcome to your board? Since you are new, we are here to work with yourselves, and we are happy with the work that you have done and the work that the organization has continued to do. Within that, in this MTF, we should target pure clean audits.
We appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
Left is for us to still meet the new minister.
Yes.
To meet him.
Thank you very much. For this purpose, I think we have come to the end of our meeting. Honourable members, can we just remain for 2 minutes so that we can be able to distribute the report that is going to be considered tomorrow?